Joel chapter 3, we're now in the last round. And this has the rather imaginative title of World View for Today. That is now looking outside of Israel, looking outside the people of God, looking into the wider world. And that, of course, is what the people of Israel were rather keen on doing, but always from the point of view that they were going to be the winners. And at last, all these horrible nations round about will get their comeuppance, and they would be clobbered one after the other, and then Israel will shine as the sun. Now, that was the popular notion, and you find it fairly common in the prophets, and that was one of the better-known aspects of the day of the Lord. The Lord is going to deal with all these nations round about that have given Israel a bad time. Well, what we've just seen in chapter 2 represents the lesser-known aspect of the day of the Lord. And they were not very popular, because what he's saying there is that all sinners are going to be punished, and that includes the sinners of Israel, Judah. And all the faithful are going to be blessed, and that's regardless of nationality, status, gender, or anything else. And that was something that they were not used to hearing, and they certainly didn't like hearing it all that much. But now you come onto the more familiar areas in chapter 3, and I should imagine that some of the listeners felt they were on more familiar territory, on safer ground here with Joel. But as you move through, you find that what Joel is really doing is repeating things that he said earlier, but in a different context. That the basic principles of judgment and blessing that he's talked about in relation to the locust plague are now being spread out on a wider canvas. So let's now just move through it as quickly as we can. He starts off by giving us a picture of the coming judgment. I spoke last night about the stylistic presentations, the poetic characteristics, the imagery and so on, and not wanting to get too stuck on the geography and the topography and the details of waiting for this bird to land in this tree and see if it precisely fulfills what that particular prophet said. They often use this broad imagery to convey God's conquest of the enemies. And the picture is usually concerning Jerusalem. And on this occasion, the enemy nations are gathering around Jerusalem to launch an attack. But they don't realize that God has brought them there so that he can get rid of them all the quicker and easier, all in one place at the one time. And so he had brought them there. In verse 2, I am going to gather these nations, says God. He's going to restore the fortunes of Jerusalem and Judah, and he is going to gather these nations there so that he can deal with them. They're going to come down to the valley of Jehoshaphat. The valley of Jehoshaphat was a valley around Jerusalem. As you know, Jerusalem is on a hill, and there are various valleys, and so these nations are coming and gathering in the valley of Jehoshaphat, and they're going to attack the walls of Jerusalem. And God is then going to enter into judgment with them. It's amazing how all the leaders of the world, all the way through history, and even today, they're all fairly cocksure of themselves, and they all have the idea that they are determining world events, and they have the firepower to do this or that according to whatever policy they think is right, normally the one which is in their best interest, and so they carry out their plans. But what they don't realize is that behind the scenes, God is doing something, and God is bringing his purposes to pass. And many of them are thumbing their noses at God. Some of them don't believe in him, some of them do. But they're not the ones who are really going to determine world history or how it all finishes up. God is ultimately in control. And so God is behind this as these enemies come to the valley outside Jerusalem to attack. But God is now going to enter into judgment with them. That is, he is going to judge them on account of my people and my heritage, Israel, because they have dealt badly with my people. They've scattered them among the nations. They divided up their land. They've been greedy. They've been oppressive. They've been heartless. And now I'm going to deal with them. That is the way God acts. And ultimately, even in this day and age, we have many nations that are dealing with God's people badly, more martyrs, than we've ever had before, probably in the last 40, 50, 60 years, and more people died for the sake of Christ than in the whole previous history of the world. You've got these very awful nations like Sudan and Saudi Arabia and North Korea and Yemen and Vietnam and Laos doing horrible, terrific, awful, bad things to the people of God, slaughtering them, locking them up, and carrying out all sorts of atrocities against them, thinking that they are exercising their muscle to fight against God. But in the end, God is the one who's going to deal with these people, and he's going to deal with them on account of my people. And so we should be looking at world affairs not in relation to power play between major powers, but we as Christians should be looking at how is this affecting the church? How is it affecting the Christians in these countries? And very often the Christians are the ones who suffer most. They never seem to be the favourites with anybody, whether it's the West fighting the communists or whether it's the West fighting the Muslims. The meat in the sandwich always happens to be the Christians, and they are the ones who inevitably finish up worse off. And so it is that God takes account of how his people suffer, and those who cause them to suffer, whether directly or indirectly, who are behind it, they are the ones who are going to suffer the judgment of God eventually. And that's what he says in verse 2. These people in verse 3 have cast lots over my people. They've just treated them as if just they're pawns in a game. They're just merchandise that they can buy and sell. They don't stop and think that these are actually human beings made in the image of God living here. But no, they're just sitting in some office, carving the whole thing up and working out what they're going to do with no real consideration of who these people are. Just like casting lots over them. And they've given a boy for a harlot, they've sold a girl for wine, and they've drunk it. People sold into prostitution, people sold into slavery, all sorts of horrendous things happening. So God is going to enter into judgment. You then have another little section in verses 4 to 8 where the enemies of God seem to be symbolized by Tyre and Sidon in the north, which is present-day Lebanon, and Philistia in the south, which of course is the Gaza Strip more or less today. I'm not saying that these particular statements concern present-day nations. I'm just letting you know where these nations are that he's referring to here. The nations are, of course, Tyre and Sidon of the prophet's time and Philistia of the prophet's time. And these people have been doing ungentlemanly things to the people of Israel and Judah, and now they're going to get paid back in verse 4. God says to them, are you paying me back for something? Well, if you're paying me back, I'm going to requite your deeds upon your own head, swiftly and speedily. You don't like my people, and so you thought that by persecuting and carrying out these atrocities against my people, you'd be getting square with me. Well, I'm going to get square with you, says God, and I'm going to requite your deeds upon your own head, swiftly and speedily. One of those statements that you find in various forms in virtually every book of the Bible. What you sow, you reap. Sooner or later, that's the way it works out. Don't like to think about it, but that's the way it is. God treats us the way we treat others. Very sobering thought. What you sow, sooner or later, you'll reap. And he says it to these people here, and it's said right through the Bible, and it's said to Christians just as well, just the same, and we do well to take notice of it. He goes on to say in verse 5, that you've carried away my silver and my gold, so greed again. Greed is at the root of so much of the evil that's in the world. In fact, our country seems to be driven by greed. And in fact, most of Western society is driven by greed, acquisitiveness, the desire for more and more and more. And God's not happy about that. You carried my rich treasures into your temples. That was one way of showing who was boss. They conquered the people of Israel and then took the treasures of Israel's temple, put them in their own temple, and that showed whose God was the stronger. You've sold the people in verse 6 of Judah and Jerusalem to the Greeks, slavery or whatever. You've removed them far away from their own border. You've taken them into foreign captivity. And now, verse 7, I'm going to stir them up from the place to which you've sold them, and I will requite your deeds upon your own head. and I will sell your sons and your daughters into the hand of the sons of Judah. You've treated them like that, I will treat you in the same way. And they in turn will sell them off to the Sabaeans, to a nation afar off. The Lord has spoken. You cannot mess around and just think that you can treat God and his people as you wish and get away with it. And that must be a tremendous encouragement to God's people in so many of the difficult countries. You ought to go to Sudan. You probably read about it. I don't know. They've managed not to put too much of this on the news because the Christians are the ones who are copping it in Sudan. It obviously is the disaster area of the world. And millions of Christians who've died over the last 30 years of this longest running civil war in the world. And they think they can get away with it. Well, they may appear to be getting away with it, but God has a bigger view of things. And that's one thing this chapter is telling us. That in the end, God's will is going to be done. And those who deal this way with God's people are going to be dealt with by God accordingly. It's very difficult to see what's happening in the world when you're in the middle of it. That's why the Apostle Paul is so perceptive in Romans 9, 10 and 11, when he could see in his own era, round about the AD 50s or whatever it was, he could see that the basic balance of the church had changed forever. That it was a dramatic change. Now, most other people didn't see it because they thought the church was the flow on from Israel, and all the early Christians, of course, in the early chapters of Acts were all Jews. And then Paul went around preaching, and some Jews believed, but most of them threw him out, and then there was a response among the Gentiles. And most people couldn't see that fundamentally the whole structure of the church was changing. But Paul saw it. And he gave the illustration of the tree. And he said it's like branches are getting broken off. This tree, the family of God, used to be Jewish in its roots, trunk, branches, the lot. But now the branches are getting broken off. And there are Gentile branches getting grafted in. And the tree is actually now looking more and more Gentile. And by the time you finish the New Testament era, it's virtually 100% Gentile. And the Jews have sort of disappeared. And Paul can see this. But most other people didn't see it. It was a radical change in the perception of what the church was. And that man was a remarkable man. He was a one-off, really, in his insight into what God was doing. Because, as I say, when you're standing in it, it's very difficult to know what's going on. Now, you and I can look back to 50 years ago, World War II, or you can look back to World War I, or you can look back to things that happened many decades ago, and we can see now how the face of the world was changing. But here we are living right now in the midst of all sorts of things. Who knows how it's going to fall out? But one thing I think we can be certain of is that, again, the whole structure of the church is changing. In the last 25 years, it has changed radically, as I mentioned in my opening talk, so that the church is no longer predominantly people from the West. It's now predominantly people from the non-West. And God is doing wonderful things. And the world is being evangelized in a way that it's never been evangelized in 2,000 years. We are living in the day of greatest evangelization since New Testament times. But the evangelization is not coming from the West. It's coming from these other countries, from people within their countries and spilling over the borders. The second largest missionary-sending country now is Korea. It's now surpassed the United Kingdom. America is still the biggest. But you've got countries like Indonesia, of all places, and the Philippines, and especially Nigeria and Brazil. Hundreds and hundreds of missionaries they're sending out. We in Bridgeway, we're supporting Nigerian missionaries with resources in, I think, 11 African countries. Wherever you go, you seem to meet Nigerians and Brazilians and Koreans. And the whole structure is changing. God is doing things today. And many of us are unaware of it. This great shift. Who knows what will happen out of China? Never in history has anything happened such as is happening in China now. The greatest turning of any people to God in history. Certainly, since New Testament times, never has there been something like 100 million people in one country. Mind you, other countries haven't had 100 million people. But that quantity of people, 100 million, no matter how many you start with, that's an awful lot of people coming from rank atheism to Christ and transforming not only the face of China, but who knows where it could go in the future. There could be a whole army of Chinese missionaries out there in another 10 or 15, 20 years' time. So things are just changing. And here we are, right in the middle of it. And it's as if this church, which has been Western, which has been European for so long, the branches are being broken off. It's almost a complete rerun, actually, of the Old Testament. You know, Abraham back there 2,000 years before Jesus. And you get the Jewish family. And then you come to Jesus and they reject him anyway. And in 2,000 years they did nothing. They were supposed to evangelize the world, but they did nothing. They all sat around in Israel and said, "Isn't it wonderful? We're God's people. Not the Gippos, not the Arabs, not these, not those, but us. Oh, praise the Lord, hallelujah, write some more psalms." And they all sat around there in this holy huddle. And they didn't move. They didn't even get as far from here to Sydney in 2,000 years. And not a very adventurous sort of evangelism they were carrying on. And then, of course, we come to the time of Christ and we get the New Testament, and then the Gentiles respond. And so Israel misses out and the Gentiles become the church, and the church then flourishes and spreads all over Europe. And in no time we find Europe is almost Christian. And what does Europe do? It does exactly the same as the people of Israel did. After they got themselves all nicely settled, after the first couple of hundred years, they all sat round and said, "Well, isn't it great? Hey, Europe is Christian." And they didn't care about the rest of the world. And it went on for 1,000 years. It went on until the year 1800, and Europe had still done nothing with the gospel, virtually, until William Carey started the modern missionary movement, and took them a while to get above 1% of non-Western people in the church. And then it got to 2% and 5%. And you get even to the turn of this century, and it was only a couple of percent. And then you get to 50 years ago, and it got up to about 20%. But now it's taken off. And now the church is predominantly non-Western. So it's as if those branches are getting broken off. And so those European branches have been broken off. And now the African, and the Asian, and the Latin American, and the Eastern European, all these other branches are grafted in. And so the church is taking a different shape. Now we're living in that, just as Paul was living in those great changes in early times. But as I say, so often we fail to see these things. The world is being evangelized as it never has before, but the church is suffering as it never has before. More suffering today in the church than there's ever been. And the atrocities that are going on, and the persecution and the jailing of Christians, is something awful. And so the two things go together. Because Satan is not going to lie low and do nothing. When God's people get mobile, Satan also gets mobile. If God's people are all asleep, well, Satan lets them go because they're no great threat to him. But as soon as they get mobile, then the opposition comes. And if we are going to do something for Christ, and we're going to talk about some renewal and revival, we can expect also that there'll be increased opposition. Because the enemy is not going to sit down and just let it happen. And that's what's occurring in all these nations where persecution is so rife. And the opposition to Christians is so brutal. Satan is not allowing this progress to go without challenge. And so as we get towards the climax of the age, I'm not sure where it's going to happen. I don't know when Jesus Christ is going to return. I don't know when the final wrap-up of things will occur. Nobody does. But we do know, as the Apostle Paul said, it's nearer now than when we first believed. So it's getting closer, but that's about all we can say. But as it moves closer and closer, we will see greater and greater evangelism. We'll see greater and greater persecution. We'll see more blessing in the church. We'll see more suffering in the church. And I think this is borne out as you read the books of the Bible. And here we are living in this today. Very eventful times in which you and I are living. Better come back to Joel chapter 3. Yeah, verse 9, proclaim among the nations, prepare war, stir up the mighty men. This is a bit of irony. He's being a little bit sarcastic, I suppose you might say. He's urging all the enemies to make full preparation for war. Come on, all you people out there, you people who hate Israel and want to polish off Judah. get yourselves ready, put on your best armor, sharpen up your swords, get your big firepower, get your big heavy weaponry, all your weapons of mass destruction, get them all finely tuned. Let the men of war draw near. Let them all come. Beat your plowshares into swords. Just the opposite of what one of the other prophets said when he said, beat your swords into plowshares. Stop fighting and do more peaceful things. No, you guys, you've got to do it the other way around because you need more weapons. So give up your agriculture and turn it into weaponry. Change your pruning hooks into spears. And let the weak say, I'm a warrior. You need more soldiers. Come on, all you guys, build up. Assemble yourselves, verse 11, hasten and come, all you nations round about, gather yourselves here, because I am going to polish you off. That's what the prophet is saying in the name of God. When he's got them all there in verse 11, then, at the end of verse 11, bring down your warriors, O Lord, your angelic armies, or whoever, to come down and annihilate all these enemies. So that is the drift of the chapter. Gather all these enemy nations, gather them together in the valley of Jehoshaphat, bring them all together in one place at one time, and when they're all there, ready to fight, God now comes in and zaps them just like that. And so verse 12, the nations bestir themselves and they come to the valley of Jehoshaphat, and there says God, I am going to sit and judge all of you nations. The verdict is that they are guilty. They are guilty of these atrocities against God's people. They are sinners under his judgment. And then you have two pictures of judgment. Put in the sickle, for the harvest is ripe. That's the first picture of judgment. Reaping a harvest, the grim reaper. Put in the sickle, the harvest is ripe. And the second picture, go in and tread, for the winepress is full. Sloshing around in the grapes, sloshing around in the wine press, sloshing around in the blood of all these people who are going to be butchered in the coming judgment. And the vats overflow because the wickedness of these people is great. Multitudes of them in verse 14. This valley of God's judgment, multitudes in the valley of decision. When it says the valley of decision, the multitude, this is not talking about a Billy Graham crusade or multitudes coming out to make a decision for Christ. It's talking about multitudes gathered together by God in the valley where he makes his decision, he makes his judgment, and he says, you're guilty and you are going to fall under my wrath. That's what the valley of decision is. It's the valley of God's decision in judgment against the enemy. The day of the Lord is near. You see it is again? The day of the Lord, of God's intervention in judgment. It's the valley of decision. And once again, verse 15, the sun and the moon are darkened. It's the day of the Lord. The stars withdraw their shining. So God comes in and acts. You move on to verse 16. When God acts against his people, I beg your pardon, acts against his enemies, he also acts to deliver his people. And so you have this picture of purification, of delivering his people. In verse 16, the Lord now roaring from Zion, and he's uttering his voice from Jerusalem. And once again, the heavens and the earth shake. But the Lord is a refuge to his people and a stronghold to the people of Israel. So he's delivering his people. He's purifying them. He's making them safe. He's blessing them in verse 17. Once again, they shall know that he is God. Those who dwell in Zion, my holy mountain, and Jerusalem shall be holy, and strangers shall never again pass through it. And so we have a repetition of what was said in chapter 2. As God comes in blessing, his people have learnt the lesson, and they know God better. They realize that he is God, he is in control, and then they're purified, and they become the sort of people they ought to be. You come to the New Testament and you find the same sort of thing. When Paul was writing to the Thessalonians, he said, from you has sounded out the word. And it's gone right through that region of Greece. Many people have become Christians. Then he writes a bit later on, and he said, you've been suffering. But God is going to intervene in judgment, and he's going to bring judgment upon those who persecute you and deliverance to those who are persecuted. That's in 2 Thessalonians chapter 1. A consistent theme. I said last night how we get these themes going through a pattern, a rhythm through the Bible, all the way through Old Testament, New Testament. But basically, God is doing the same sorts of things. And so he does to his church. And so today people can take courage, those who are suffering. The day is coming, the day of the Lord, when God will intervene. And then the persecutors will be the ones who suffer. And the persecuted will be those who find deliverance and peace with God. And as I speak to some of these Christians in these countries, just how they take courage, they take encouragement from the Word of God. It just lifts you up to see people in awful circumstances just being so positive and so optimistic and praising the Lord and grabbing hold of these truths that God ultimately will not leave them or forsake them. And that those who do them ill, in the end, they will get their just deserts. So I've got a couple of references there from 2 Thessalonians that you can read for yourself. Jerusalem is saved in verse 17. The people of Israel know God better. Verse 18, prosperity returns. And again we have an echo of what was said in chapter 2. The mountains drip sweet wine. The hills flow with milk. The stream beds of Judah flow with water. And a fountain shall come forth from the house of the Lord. And so having punished his enemies, God now dwells among his people forever. It's a very typical scene for one of these prophets as they look to that great intervention of God and the righting of wrongs and how his people will be blessed. The enemies in the last couple of verses are now represented by Egypt and Edom. Earlier they were represented by a few other countries in verses 4 to 8, and here in verse 19 they're represented this time by Egypt. You can go around a lot of other countries. You can go around Babylon and Syria and Assyria and other people, but they just pick out a few of them here and say Egypt is going to become a desolation. Edom shall be a desolate wilderness. Why? Because of the violence done to the people of Judah and because they shed innocent blood in their land. That is always the supreme justification for God's intervention and for God's dealing with these people, because they persecuted the Christians or the believers or his people. God is dealing with them on the same basis. Again, here we are in Joel. You go through the New Testament. I've just quoted from Thessalonians. You get to the end of the Bible in the book of Revelation. And you have another picture. And this is of the destruction of Babylon. And it goes through all the greed and injustice that characterized Babylon. And at the end of chapter 18 of Revelation, it says Babylon is also destroyed. And after it's listed all the sins of Babylon, the very last verse says, but the supreme justification for God's dealing with Babylon is that in her was found the blood of the prophets and of the saints and of all those who've been slain on the earth. God is still on the throne and he does remember his own. And in his time and in his way, all those people who think that they are stomping on God and crushing his people, they're going to find that in the end, they are the ones who are stomped on and crushed, and God's people shine in brightness and salvation. They overcame by the blood of the Lamb and the word of their testimony. And after they're overcome, you read on in chapter 19, and then you have this picture. I saw heaven opened and a new Jerusalem coming down out of heaven, and so it goes on. You have the same thing here. After the destruction of these people because of the violence done to God's people, verse 20, Judah will then be inhabited forever, and Jerusalem to all generations. I will avenge their blood, and I will not clear the guilty, says the Lord, who dwells in Zion. And so there you have a sort of quick run through and an overview of the better known aspects of the day of the Lord. Now I just want to look at those 2 days of the Lord so that we can see how they all fit together. We ought not to read chapter 3 independently of chapters 1 and 2. The day of the Lord in the locust plague was but a forerunner of the great day of the Lord that will wrap up things at the end of the age. So I've got a little bit of a contrast there of some verses that I've set out for you. First of all, we look at judgment. I'll just read these to you. If you look at the locust plague day of the Lord in chapter 2, verses 2 and 3, it was a day of darkness and gloom. Blackness spread upon the mountains, fire devouring before them, and behind them a flame burns. That was in the locust plague day of the Lord. If you look at the final great day of the Lord, in chapter 2, verse 30, again, portents in the heavens and on the earth, blood and fire and columns of smoke. The locust plague day of the Lord, in chapter 2, the first half of verse 10, the earth quakes before them and the heavens tremble. The final great day of the Lord, in chapter 3, verse 16, the Lord roars, he utters his voice from Jerusalem, and again the heavens and the earth shake. In the locust plague day of the Lord, in the second half of chapter 2, verse 10, the sun and the moon are darkened, and the stars withdraw their shining. In the final great day of the Lord, in chapter 3, verse 15, the sun and the moon are darkened, and the stars withdraw their shining. In the locust plague day of the Lord, in chapter 2, verse 11, the Lord utters his voice before his army, and his host is exceedingly great. In the final great day of the Lord, chapter 3, verse 11, bring down your warriors, O Lord. Again, the army is the Lord's carrying out his judgment. And so you can see those parallels of one into the other as Joel has built this message together. So much for judgment. Now look at blessing. In the locust plague day of the Lord following the judgment, there was blessing in chapter 2, verses 23 and 24. The threshing floors are full of grain. The vats are overflowing with wine and oil. And I'm going to restore to you those years that the locust ate. I've read verse 24. I should have read verse 23, where God says, I'm going to give you early rain for your vindication. I'm going to pour down abundant rain. I'm going to give you early and latter rain. And then your threshing floors will be full and your vats will overflow and so on. When you come to the final great day of the Lord in chapter 3, verse 18, the same thing. The mountains are going to drip sweet wine. The hills flow with milk. And all the stream beds of Judah, once again, are going to flow with water, and a fountain is going to come forth from the house of the Lord. One other aspect of the blessing in chapter 27, verse A, chapter 2, verse 27a. You shall know that I am in the midst of Israel, and I, the Lord, am your God, and there's none else. The final great day of the Lord, chapter 3, verse 17, once again. You shall know that I am the Lord your God who dwell in Zion, my holy mountain. And in the locust plague day of the Lord at the end of verse 27, my people shall never again be put to shame. The final great day of the Lord in chapter 3 at the end of verse 17, Jerusalem again shall not be put to shame and never again shall strangers pass through it. And so that actually gives us the picture now of tying together these two apparently quite different parts of the book, bringing it together and showing how this man was getting his message across. Not only giving them a message for their own day and generation, but looking to the future. Now the people of Israel like chapter 3 much better than I like chapter 2. Because in chapter 3, I always finish on top and all the enemies get their comeuppance. And we're a bit the same, of course. We like all that stuff about the victory and so on. We're not always that keen on the sort of thing in chapter 2. We like to think of the victory, the end of the age, the return of Christ, the triumph of all things good, chapter 3. But in chapter 2, he's saying, but what about the present? You've got to get that straight. And you might need to pull a few things into line and repent and turn to God. And so it goes on. Okay, so what is the challenge for us today? Well, I think the reminder that comes out of this book is that obedience to God, not nationality, is the really important thing. God's got no vested interest in us. There's no particular reason why the European races have got to be preserved. and all the rest can go down the gurgler. But somehow, we've got this mental picture that God has a vested interest in us. I'm sure most Australians, if there was a fight between Australia and Indonesia, they think, oh, we've got to win because we're white, we're Australians, and we're Christian. Well, I'm not quite sure about Australia being very Christian. And when it comes to the number of Christians, Indonesia's got a lot more Christians than Australia, got a lot more people than Australia. But even the percentage of Christians might even be higher. Born-again Christians I'm talking about. Virile church in Indonesia, sending out missionaries and doing wonderful things. But that's not really... I mean, God's not going to sit down and count the number of Christians and say, I'll let them win because they've got more Christians. All I'm saying is that we've got it all wrong. If there's a war on in the Gulf with Western powers coalition against all these Muslim characters, and somehow we say, well, God's on our side and he's not on their side. It's the wrong way to be thinking. That's the way the people of Israel thought. And Jeremiah comes to them and says, you got it all wrong. He said he's going to use these Babylonians, who incidentally come from the same part of the world in Mesopotamia there, he's going to use those Babylonians to destroy Jerusalem. And they said, but he can't. I mean, we're his people. We've got the temple here. He wouldn't let filthy Babylonians walk into the temple. He won't even let us walk into the innermost parts of the temple. And Jeremiah said he will. They thought the temple would give them protection. And Jeremiah said, no, it won't. The Babylonians will come and they'll knock it down. And they'll cut all you people off into captivity as well. But they can't do that. This is the promised land. God gave it to Abraham and he gave it to us. And he said, it's yours in perpetuity. So we can stay here. And Jeremiah and all these other prophets, they had to say, look, you've got it wrong. And God showed that they had it wrong. And he did allow the Babylonians to come in. And the Israelites didn't win. It was the Babylonians who won. And the temple didn't guarantee their safety. It got knocked down and destroyed. And Jesus said the same sort of thing. He said, this temple, not going to be one stone left upon the other. It doesn't guarantee your security. The Romans this time will come in and they'll knock it all down. And you people are going to go with it. Unless you change and say, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord, unless you welcome the Messiah that's been sent to you. And so we've got to realize that God is not working on the basis of nationality. And God doesn't have any particular obligation to preserve Western society. Other great civilizations have gone down the gurgler long before us. And who knows where the whole thing might finish. Well, I was in England a few years ago when the World Cup soccer was on. You remember England got beaten by Brazil? And it was semi-finals or quarter-finals or something. But it was the match because whoever won that match had a fair chance of winning the final. And, of course, England got beaten. And it was a day of national mourning. I couldn't believe it. Oh, flags were half-mast. Everybody's walking around as if the end of the age was about to fall. But even on the front page of the Times or the Daily Telegraph, one of the clergy, a bishop or someone, had composed a prayer to pray to God for England to win. Something went wrong, but England didn't win. I was preaching in a church that particular Sunday, and everybody's coming along in a state of deep depression, and I said, you know, why are you taking this so seriously? It was all right for me, you see, I wasn't part of it. But I said, do you think God is really all that uptight over a football match? That somehow England had to win because we're a Christian nation. I said there are more Christians in Brazil than in England. Not that God's totting up the number of Christians and making them the winner, but there are more Christians in the Brazilian team than there are in the English team too. But that doesn't guarantee victory either. But the unspoken assumption was that God must help us because we're British or we're Australian or whatever it happens to be. Not at all. Do we not read the Bible? Do we not understand what God was saying to the people of Israel? They deceived themselves in a big way. And they had all sorts of covenant promises that they were relying on far more than we have any national promises of that nature. But they still learnt the hard way that they did not have God on a string. And in the end, the nation was conquered. It wasn't the end of the story, of course. It came back and it got conquered again. But the lesson is there for us. God is not obligated to us. And that is coming through this book of Joel. God is under no obligation to preserve our way of life or our standard of living. In fact, I think we ought to be doing something about lowering our standard of living, which of course would not win any votes at an election because everyone's promising to raise the standard even further. But when the distance is getting further and further away, we're getting more and more removed. The rich are getting richer, the poor are getting poorer. And the wealthier nations are getting more powerful and richer, and the poorer nations are getting more and more driven into the ground. And sooner or later, the whole thing's got to blow up, surely. We ought to be doing something as Christians to reverse that trend, whatever way possible, through our tithes and offerings, through our churches, through our mindset, through our talk, through lowering our standard of living, through living on less and giving more away. Some way we've got to find ways and means of helping. It says to the rich at the end of Timothy, I think it is, at the end of 1 Timothy, it says something to the rich that says, if you are rich, then you've got to be rich in good deeds as well, and you've got to be liberal and generous, and in this way you'll lay up for yourselves a good foundation for the future. So if you've got a lot of it, give a lot of it away. That's what he's really saying. We are stewards. And the people to whom we give, if we're giving to people in Christian activities in other countries, they're stewards too. And we've got to accept that we should not use money or material wealth to dictate terms, adopt a sort of economic imperialism. But if we help our brothers and sisters in these poor countries in whatever way possible, well, we're stewards of what God's given us. And when we give it to them, well, they're stewards likewise. And we've got to put trust in them and realize that they are answerable to God and not use money to exercise control, the sort of thing that we do in our Western society. No, we've got to treat people as equals. We've got to enter into partnerships with some of these folks round about and do whatever is possible to help the Church of God around the world. Do good to all men, sure, but especially those of the household of faith. And if we see our brothers and sisters in need and we shut up our hearts of compassion against them, well, how dwells the love of God in us? That was a question that one of the New Testament writers asked, and it's worth asking ourselves. And so we might have to change a few things. I hope we do. And who knows, said Joel, who knows? God might even change too and leave a blessing behind.
Thank you very much, Don. I know you won't believe this, but Graham has suggested to me that I summarise all the talks that we've had. But I'm going to do it in 1 minute, and I promise you it will be in 1 minute. I was reading just the other day that the famous philosopher Will Rogers was asked a seemingly stupid question by someone, how can you shorten the shipping time between New York and London? And he thought for a little while and he said, that's easy. Just boil all the oceans of the world, because ships travel faster in boiling water. And some very, very wise person was there said, but how do you boil all the oceans of the world? And Rogers said, I've given you the solution. You go and work out the details. And the question I'd like to leave you with as we go now is this. How do you get from the siege mentality that seems to beset us to getting the troops charging up the ramparts of the citadels of Satan? Our brothers have given us the solution. You go home and work out the details.